Hey, welcome along. It's 4 p.m. On a Tuesday afternoon, North American Eastern Time. That's 8 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, 9 p.m. in London, where they're on BST. That's Bovine Spongiform Time. Oh, my mistake. It's British Summer Time. And that makes it 2 a.m. in Colombo in Sri Lanka, which is part of what's on my mind this edition of Clubland Q&A, where, by the way, this may, I'm not sure, we may have one more, but this may be, oh, it's Wednesday. By the way, if you all could, yeah, that's it. We normally do these on Tuesday. That's, I've got the day wrong. It's Wednesday or Thursday if you're in Sri Lanka and parts east of there. But anyway, it is Wednesday or Thursday. It's definitely not Tuesday, unless it's still Tuesday on Pacific time. It must still be Tuesday in Hawaii, mustn't it? Anyway, before we get down to business, we're approaching the second birthday of the Mark Stein Club. And as we start our third year, we have various new things planned for you. We'll have some second birthday observances, as we did last year. I think we had a big special with me talking to various people who've had number one hit records, and I'm not really sure what we're going to do this year, but I suppose we'll be talking to people who've had number two hit records, and that format could get pretty tiresome by the time we get to our 37th birthday, but we're going to stick with it because that's the kind of people we are. And we got a big cruise coming up, and it's all but sold out. But we can, contact us, we can maybe still squeeze you in the hold, down with the fellas with pustules all over their face and boils and scurvy, rowing away furiously. We can probably still get you in. And that starts September 4th. We leave from Vancouver, British Columbia, and we'll be sailing up through Alaska to Glacier Bay, the Inside Passage up to Glacier Bay and Ketchikan, and we hope you will join. By the way, you can listen anywhere in the world to this. You don't have to be a Mark Stein Club member, and we're happy to have you with us. And if you want to ask a question, all you got to do is join the club, and if you join the club, I might get to your question before we're done today. But let us get to the main topics of interest. I was really actually quite shocked by the American and British media coverage. I checked in with a little bit of Australian coverage as well, news coverage on Sunday of the Easter morning attacks in Sri Lanka, because it was perfectly obvious what they were from the beginning. And if you actually read, say, the newspapers in India, they were perfectly straightforward about what was going on. The newspapers and the television and radio in the United States and the United Kingdom and elsewhere were not in the least bit straightforward about what was going on, and seemed anxious to present it as a resurgence of the Sri Lankan civil war with the Tamil Tigers that ended 10 years ago. And sometimes things aren't the same. Sometimes something different is going on. And in this case, it's actually not all that much different. It's actually the same story that's going on all over the map, which is that we have a resurgent, ever more confident Islam that is disinclined to live with the other. And that is what was going on in Sri Lanka. And the fact that 10 years ago in Sri Lanka, an entirely different situation was going on is irrelevant. Yet if you had listened to most of the Western news coverage, you would have thought that it was a return of the Sri Lankan civil war. At some point, there will be some kind of one of these motor vehicle riding up onto the sidewalk things in Belfast, in Northern Ireland. Some guy will get in a car and decide to mow down people on a street in Belfast. And if you listen to the news coverage, they will be talking about the Easter Agreement, the Good Friday Agreement, and a return of sectarian violence, and Protestants and Catholics and Loyalists and Republicans, and the Easter Uprising and the Irish Civil War and God knows what else, but they'll talk about anything except what it actually is. Let's get to your questions. Paul Cathy writes, after days of receiving no help from the Western media, ISIS finally had to state the obvious and take credit for the Easter bombings. Not to be deterred, National Public Radio in America, interviewing some Brit about this on Here and Now yesterday, managed to turn the conversation to Buddhist on Muslim crime and the possible resurgence of the Tamil Tigers, all in the breathless "we're on top of this story" voice employed by a terminally clueless journo propagandist. Yeah, they're actually not giving up on this. They've got this thing in the New York Times. I think this was yesterday. Sri Lanka and the venomous spread of terror. The quote, there's a lot we still don't know about the Easter Sunday attacks in Sri Lanka. Yeah, there's a lot you still don't know if you read the New York Times. But they've gone on. We've seen it all again and again in Christchurch. That's the first one they put, Christchurch. So in other words, there's not perpetrators and victims. There's just a general phenomenon here. As Randy Boyagoda, Canadian novelist and academic of Sri Lankan ancestry, wrote in an op-ed for The Times, the bombings were terrible, local, and familiar. And there's two words there that, with respect to Mr. Boyagoda, are wrong. They were not local, and I'll come back to that point. And in that sense, they were not familiar because they were not arising from the Sri Lankan civil war. On the surface, says the New York Times, Easter attacks had a different local plot than the Civil War. The latter was fought along ethnic lines, while the attacks were apparently sectarian. But generations reared in violence are likely to have it in their blood. As the new Irish Republican Army, radical heir to Republican paramilitaries of Northern Ireland's long sectarian feud of decades past, demonstrated last week during riots in which the police suspect that a member shot dead a reporter. It's very hard to follow what they're saying there. What they mean is a member of the new IRA, who are the successors to the real IRA, who are the successors to the provisional IRA, who are, well, let's not get into that. Anyway, they shot dead a young 28-year-old reporter last Thursday. A terrible thing, absolutely terrible, horrific thing. But it is actually not the same as what is going on Easter in Sri Lanka. And just to return to that point about they were local, you know, the guy saying it was local and familiar. I had all these arguments almost 15 years ago now with the late Christopher Hitchens, a very great and shrewd mind. But there's a tendency to let expertise get in the way of seeing the obvious. And Christopher had travelled a lot of places and he'd seen a lot of things. And so naturally, when you watch TV or you read a blog or whatever, people, a lot of the time, people are just, as they used to say, sitting in their pajamas, blogging about stuff they don't know anything about. And Christopher was always at pains to point out that there's a lot of difference between, say, British Pakistanis living in Yorkshire and Moroccans living in Amsterdam and Turks living in Germany and all the rest of it. And I used to say, yeah, all that's true. There's lots of fascinating. There's fascinating differences between Yorkshiremen and Lancashiremen. There's fascinating differences between Lowland Scots and Highland Scots. But in the end, the fascinating local differences that people talk about with reference to Europe, for example, in the end, there are fascinating differences between an imperial power such as the UK or France that has former colonial populations living in the metropolis and an essentially non-imperial power such as Sweden or Germany. So you can say at a certain level the reasons why there are Turks in Germany are completely different from the reasons why there are Pakistanis in the UK. And they're certainly very different from the reasons why Sweden has a big surging Muslim ghetto that's about to overwhelm Malmö in Sweden. But despite the fascinating differences, once you grasp the essentials of the situation, they're all the same. Once, and I'll tell you this, as someone who has gone and seen Molenbeek in Belgium and Rosengard in Sweden, and has gone to Toulouse in France, and has gone and seen Bradford in Yorkshire, and has gone all over the place, that once you've seen one Muslim ghetto in Europe, you've pretty much seen them all. It's exactly the same dynamic between the Muslim population and the non-Muslim population. Exactly the same. And I'm saying that as someone who's gone to all these places and so in NPR, PBS, BBC terms would qualify as an expert on the fascinating local differences. And the fact is, for all the fascinating local differences, what did the environmentalists say? Think globally, act locally. That's, and of course, that's like most slacktivism in the West. That's just rubbish. But it's actually true. In when it comes to the jihad, they think globally and they act locally. And so what's obvious in Sri Lanka is that it's part of the global jihad and that there is a certain proportion of young people willing to act in the... And this, again, is something new. This, again, is something new. That you get whatever you say about how the Islamic populations, the Muslim populations might have been 30, 40, 50 years ago, the new generation has a pan-Islamic identity. So the least the idiots at the New York Times and the BBC and the Globe and Mail and all the rest of them can do is stop talking about the Sri Lankan Civil War, because that ship has sailed. That's done. That's over. May come back, just like the FLQ might come back in Quebec. But right now, it's the you're saying, oh, we're such experts in the trees that we can't deal with such crude oversimplifications as the forest. You make yourself look an idiot. AB43 writes, Mark, I have a simple question related to the Sri Lankan Eastern Massacre. Why did you not mention the descent of the papacy to the level of all the leaders that apologized to the Muslims? How Pope Benedict XVI inadvertently mentioned... Well, actually, I'll tell you one thing I don't like, AB43, and that's these questions. Why didn't you mention this? Well, because you can't mention everything when you write about anything. So you mention the things that happen to be of interest to you. And if someone else... If Smith writes a piece about, the relief of Mafeking, what he'll put in there will be different from what Jones writes about the relief of Mafeking. And if Jones doesn't like what Smith writes about the relief of Mafeking, then Jones should write his own piece about the relief of Mafeking. But the point is, I don't write much about Pope Francis. I think he's a shallow and rather stupid man. But I understand that for Catholics, having a non-Catholic, my dear old mum was Catholic. And I was baptized a Catholic, but I wandered and wound up getting confirmed as an Anglican. So I'm not sure whether I'd still be considered. I mentioned when I was in the cathedral at Rouen for the funeral service of Père Hamel, who had his throat slit at Mass by these lunatics. Me and the covered lady, nice Muslima covered lady. sitting along the pew, we were the only ones who didn't get up to go and take communion. So I never feel particularly my job to moan about what a useless loser, quizzling squish appeaser this Pope is. So you can take it as read. Take it as read. I find almost everything he says utterly fatuous, whether it's on Islam or climate. Andrew Vaccaro writes, Mark, thank you for the shout-out here in Dandenong North, a large industrial hub and southeastern suburb of Melbourne in Victoria, from which your good friend John Roscombe originally hails from. John Roscombe from the IPA in Australia, and whenever we tour down in Oz, I always love, it's usually we do it in association with John, and the guys at the IPA do a cracking job, and I always enjoy, one of the great joys is being at the big IPA dinner that John hosts in Melbourne. They're always a grand gala event. Was down there last time, I think, with Alan Jones and I won the bill together. Always a lovely event. Dan, yes, I said we'd had a member from Dandenong in Melbourne, and Andrew has decided to take the plunge and ask a question. With the Sri Lankan attacks, the Notre Dame fire, and the persecution of Christians in the Western world as much as the Third World, and the lack of defense by those who should know better, why do you think the Western world, especially in the area of faith, is so hell-bent on committing cultural suicide? Was there a certain time or event that you think triggered this? In recent years, the political spectrum has gone from the varying degrees of individual freedom to the varying degrees of cultural self-loathing, with many conservatives not immune. As you know, we have a federal election in less than a month, and present polling seems to indicate Labour will win, even with their ruinous policies coming to the fore, though I believe Bill Shorten is about to do a John Hewson and lose the unlosable election. People seem willing to partake in their own demise. Why do we see this in the West and not elsewhere? Happy Easter. God bless on this Anzac Day. And please keep us sane and laughing. And if you don't know what Anzac Day is, if you're a non-Australian or New Zealander, you should know what it is. In part, a lot of this actually goes back to the Great War, Andrew, and to and actually to events like Gallipoli and the slaughter on the Western Front. I've said this before. I think, you know, generally speaking, when you have profound cultural change, it has deep roots. The 19th century was an especially confident time in the Western world generally. I'm not just speaking about the great empires, but it was true in the United States, and it was true in non-imperial powers like Germany as well. People were culturally confident and civilizationally confident. And what happened after the immense slaughter on the Western Front is that a seed of doubt was sown. And the people who survived that terrible war and lived with the consequences of that terrible war never quite believed again in the way they had done in the August, in the that last summer, August 1914. And that can corrode and corrode and corrode and corrode, and it changes from generation to generation. So in the 1960s, when you had people who, at universities, who decided they wanted to rebel against their teachers and so forth, the teachers were the great custodians of the Western inheritance. They knew about great music and great literature. They'd been immersed in it, and they taught it all their lives. So when you decide, if you're on a university campus circa 1970 and you decide you're going to get with the beat and join the counterculture, you still are doing that. You know what the counterculture is countering, because you've been immersed in the glorious inheritance of your own civilization. Now we're like three generations on. So we're being taught. So our children, the students at Western universities today, are being taught by people who don't actually know anything. That's why you have stupid stories like the one I mentioned a while back about a student, I think it was Southern New Hampshire University, who was asked to write about various countries, Andrew, and wrote about your country, your nation, Australia. And the idiot professor said, Australia is not a country, it's a continent. It happens to be a continent, but it's also a country. And so you can look it up. It's a member of the United Nations. They don't let continents be members of the United Nations. It's a member of the Commonwealth, and they don't let continents be members of the Commonwealth. It's a member of the Five Eyes Intelligence Sharing Agreement, and they don't let continents be a member of that. But this professor at Southern New Hampshire University refused to back down and was willing to destroy this young lady's life over the professor's stupidity. So we have now a generation, we have teachers who are know-nothings. And that's a terrible thing. That's a terrible thing. And I think the other point I always emphasize, which I think is worth bearing in mind, is that at a certain level, people understand this is an indulgence. Most of the battles we have are not actually about the people they purport to be about, like race grievances. In the United States, for example, are not primarily about white people and black people. They're about they're between, you know, so-called old school white people and progressive virtue signaling white people, and that's the purpose of the battle to make for example, the civil rights thing, Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, which destroyed the black family. But who cares? Because the point about the Great Society is to enable white liberals to feel good about themselves. So the fact that it destroys black families is of no relevance to them because they still feel pretty great about it all. And that's the point of a lot of these disputes. You see it when we look at this gay mayor from South Bend who's surging ahead in the polls. He's like number three behind Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders, and he's like a fifth of their age. He's like 12, and he's married to some guy, and he's the gay mayor of South Bend, Indiana, and everybody loves him. And it's something to do with... And he's a classic example. He might win the nomination. He might win the presidency. America might have its first gay president and its first gentleman, just to rub it into Hillary Clinton even more. The first gentleman in the White House will not be Bill Clinton, but will be this gay guy's husband. And that's not about gays and straights. That's about old school whites and virtue signaling white liberal progressives. And at a certain level, once you carry it to extremes, it becomes an indulgence. And because no white liberal, no upscale white liberal wants to live in Yemen. They just want a little bit of a multicultural frisson. And they don't understand, I think, that once you, at a certain point, you've adopted what you think was just like an accessory. It's just like wearing and going around with a novelty handbag or something. The accessory has actually swallowed whatever it was meant to be accessorizing. And you don't see that because you think it's just like, oh, I'll pick a little bit of this and I'll pick a little bit of that. And you don't realize that the trends you set in motion can change things very quickly. Anyway, great to have you with us, Andrew, and I hope to be in Oz very soon, with or without John Roskam. We always look forward to seeing him in Melbourne, and I hope to see you next time down in Melbourne. Great to have you with us in the club. Paul Harmon writes, the Muslim terrorists claim the attack in Sri Lanka was retribution for the attack on the mosques in Christchurch in New Zealand. I wonder what the score is. Christians destroying mosques versus Muslims destroying churches. It has to be 1 to 100 or some such. And the whole retribution idea shows that the true believer Muslims are untroubled by all the churches they've destroyed. The concept of grace is alien to them. They know only Sharia law and justice, a fact that has tremendous implications, yet no one in the press wants to discuss it. Paul, if we take it, for the purposes of argument, let's take it as real that ISIS did this in retribution for what happened in Christchurch. I would make a couple of points for that. As you say, you wonder what the score is. Well, the score in these respective mounds of corpses is 50 in Christchurch and well over 300 now in Sri Lanka. And that in itself, I think, tells you something about the scorecard. The scorecard is overwhelmingly weighted to one side. And you talk about Muslims destroying churches. Often Muslims destroy churches on our watch. One of the most shameful aspects of the Western occupation of Afghanistan and Iraq is that Afghan Christianity and Iraqi Christianity were destroyed, utterly destroyed, on our watch. The last church in Afghanistan was closed on our... That creep of a so-called president, and they, by the way, they shouldn't have even... They shouldn't have gone for a republic. They should have restored King Zahir to his throne. But that so-called president in Kabul stays alive only because of American and Western blood and treasure. And these creeps, we're spending a fortune in treasure and in blood on keeping these creeps alive. And they lack even the common decency not to do things like destroy the last church in Afghanistan, even as they're taking Western money, or even restrain themselves from passing laws making apostasy, making leaving Islam punishable by death in Afghanistan. And again, it gets to when I'm asked why I call myself an old school imperialist, if you're not promoting your values when you're wandering around the world, there's no point to it. There's no point spending 18 years running around the Hindu Kush to just set up another Islamic toilet state. No point to it at all. One other point on this business about Sri Lanka as retribution for Christchurch. The media are interested in that line because, in a sense, it blames us too, because it means like some Australian so-called white supremacist guy was the guy who pulled off Christchurch. Now, he did it all by himself. There was a sophisticated network that pulled off the Sri Lankan attacks. And again, that is the key difference, that this is a thing. Something like Christchurch is a freakish one-off, but day-to-day jihad is just a phenomenon of our times. It's part of the price of living in a big city, as Sadiq Khan, the mayor of London, says. Even he recognises it. That's the logic of that remark. Whereas when it happens in Christchurch at the hands of some kook Australian, then it's not the price of living in a big city, and somehow it's terribly urgent and something is to be done about that. And I think that unequal treatment, people understand the unequal treatment of these events and they resent it. But in a sense, it's a pointless argument. It doesn't matter whether Christchurch leads to Sri Lanka or Sri Lanka leads to Christchurch or whatever. You're going to get more of this unless you actually change the conditions on the ground. It's always difficult. When people live together in close quarters, it's always difficult. And in the case of Islam, it's particularly difficult. I was listening to some Sri Lankan Muslims talking. Very nice people. No plans to kill anyone, shoot anyone, bomb anyone. But as they were saying, they didn't put it this directly, but they said they felt really bad about what had happened on Easter morning, and they were reaching out to their Christian neighbours, and they wanted their Christian neighbours to know they felt terrible about it. But they're a naturally self-segregating community. And if you have a naturally self-segregating community, then it doesn't matter if they're, say, Mennonites in parts of Ontario. They just want to do their own thing and be slightly apart from the generality of society. It doesn't matter. But if you have a self-segregating community that nevertheless has a universalist mission, you're setting your society up for some pretty basic tensions. Kate writes, the Q&A tomorrow will roughly coincide with Anzac Day, which is a public holiday, and the dawn services, and the one at Gallipoli, because right now it's just about midnight in Gallipoli, so they're not going to be having the service for a few hours yet, but they will, whatever it is now, 5 or 6 hours, they'll be having the dawn service at Gallipoli with extra very heavy security this year, says Kate. Hope you might get to mention and or receive a question about the Anzac Cove landing in 1915, the Irish at V Beach, often overlooked, and the failed year-long campaign. As you've previously discussed, Turkey's post-World War I deterioration from Kemalist to Islamist. Whether there was any truth to Atatürk's alleged Johnny's and Mehmet's speech seems doubtful. And why we celebrate a military disaster as the defining moment in national identity is maybe a question for another time. Actually, you know, I'd say this, Kate. I've noticed in recent years, I think it was particularly true at the centenary 3 years ago. Actually, they're playing up they tend to play up the Irish contribution at Gallipoli a lot more than they used to. I noticed the Prince of Wales was accompanied by that rather touchy Irish fellow who had a go at my old pal Michael Graham a while back. As to the other point about why we celebrate military disasters, I think there's two elements to that. I think there's a certain element I think that testifies to a basic decency in our societies, that extreme moments of disaster or near disaster, such as Dunkirk, touch us especially. The Dunkirk thing, I remember seeing some American scholar on the BBC wondering why it was that Britain keeps going on about Dunkirk, which is basically a mass evacuation from the continent, and why it's not a great victory. Obviously, all it is your ensuring it's not total disaster. And I think that the reason that appeals is in part in the psyche of the men who ran the war, there is the understanding that when things go wrong, you have to either make them right at the time, as happened at Dunkirk, or as at Gallipoli, you have to acknowledge the awesome scale of what has happened. That in a sense, it is not normal just to just to lead men into terrible disasters, ill thought out, and that you have a responsibility in some sense to make something of that. Now, I don't like the thing we have here, where people see in the United States, people started driving around with yellow ribbons saying "We support our troops." About a year after the Iraq thing, what it meant was that we support our troops because we don't really support the mission. What it means is we support our troops because we've given them some thankless, bloody, hopeless task led by incompetent generals who don't actually have any victory strategy, and a faint-hearted political class that doesn't even talk about victory but just talks about exit strategy and all the rest of it. But in the meantime, we got these brave men running around on some godforsaken sod on the other side of the planet. And even though they're doing it for nothing, and even though they're just running around getting blown up by IEDs year in, year out for two decades, to the point where young men who weren't even born at the time of 9/11 are being shipped off to Afghanistan, We still feel, you know, we want to say nice things about them. And I think I take your point, Kate, but I think it actually speaks well. What we should do, though, what we should also do, insofar as we talk about Gallipoli and Dunkirk and all the rest of it, we should also recognize the phenomenal contribution to victory. And we should talk about victory, and we should talk about strategic goals, and we should talk, and we should stop being embarrassed to be us. That was the Don't Mention the Jihad piece that I reprinted yesterday at Stein Online and meant to get to. Ends up saying we got nothing to be embarrassed about. Because it's all comparative. It's all comparative. And as I said, a lot of this is just phony. You know, all the traffic's one way. We're racist, homophobe, imperialist, colonialist, whatever we are. And yet everybody, basically everybody on the planet, wants to move to a racist, imperialist, colonialist society. So that says something. That's the last word on it. Rich writes, hello, Mark. As always, love the club. The media, faint-hearted euphemists or gung-ho propagandists. Unfortunately, with regard to a majority of the mainstream media, I think we Stein Clubbers already know the answer. That said, I think the media is the system and not the disease. What I find particularly distressing is whenever there is a major incident, terrorism, gun violence, you name it, the elites within the Democratic Party generate their noble lie and blast it out to their rank-and-file members to parrot to the media. Easter worshippers, quote-unquote, a hitherto unknown phrase in the English language, were the victims in Sri Lanka. Homophobia was at the root of the Pulse nightclub shooting. An unseen YouTube video was the cause of Benghazi. You get the point. My sense is that Democrat Party bosses don't care about the multicultural endgame. They care about power, and they'll never let a good crisis go to waste. Yeah, I think there's a real, again, which in a sense, the Pulse nightclub thing was like the Sri Lanka thing. It wasn't about what it seemed to be about, what they would have liked. When somebody goes in and shoots up a gay nightclub, basically Democrats want it to be a redneck Second Amendment NRA nut. That's who they want to have done it. And so when it turns out to be some Afghan immigrant guy, that kind of wrecks the whole thing for them. The story's no fun anymore if they can't hang it round the neck of the redneck right-wing gun nut. And so then they have to, their way of dealing with it is just to sideline what's really going on. And make it, and you say they made it about homophobia. No, what was interesting to me is that they actually made it about gun control. You know, in it's not. It's about what happens when you put. It's about what happens when you have a rainbow coalition that pretends there's no difference between hardcore Sharia law Muslims and hedonist. Boutique sexual identities favoured by the Democrat Party. And there are contradictions to that. If you like the gay life, there's going to be a lot less of it, just as there's fewer gay bars in Amsterdam than there were 20 years ago, and there's fewer gay pubs in the East End of London 20 years ago. Ask yourself why that is. And Democrats and liberals and progressives and all the rest of it should ask themselves once in a while why that is. Why is that? Why is that? Somehow, deep down, you can't be as stupid as the parroted lines suggest. You know something's going on here. And as long as you... So one gay guy hung on a fence in Wyoming 20 years ago, indicted a whole nation. It was about... Americans, systemic homophobia. One gay guy hung on a fence. 50 gay guys dead in a nightclub in Florida. And that's just something to do with gun control. It's very difficult to deal with people who lie to themselves. Susan Thomas writes, thanks so much, Mark, for all your wonderful articles, tales, presentations, and appearances of all kind. Regarding Bill de Blasio's absurd proposal to ban skyscrapers from New York, and ultimately the world, of course, do you think he has considered the consequences, aside from the challenge of taking down all the existing vertical structures? That's going to be a lot of controlled explosions. You know something? This is the literal stupidity of the Democrat left. That a mayor of New York, 18 years after 9/11, has now decided he wants to take down the skyscrapers too. That's brilliant. That's genius.
What would he do with the peoples and materials therein? Everything would have to be spread horizontally instead. So the city would expand to cover hundreds upon hundreds of additional square miles, like an oil slick spreading on the sea. It's especially amusing because environmentalists in the 1980s promoted the opposite view, i.e. concentration of populations in high-rise urban centres to avoid loss of agricultural lands and open spaces to residential business use through the creation of huge spreading low-rise cities and the roads, utilities, etc. that they would require. Can you imagine the enormous footprint of a one- or two-story high New York City? You know, Susan, that is a brilliant point. I'm not particularly a kind of skyscraper guy myself because I live in the country. But I remember doing a BBC show years ago, must be early 90s, something like that. And we were talking about how high skyscrapers can go. And they were explaining that actually the problem, the construction restraints were imposed mainly by the need for bigger and bigger elevator banks, that there was not, they had to work out ways to get the further high up in the sky you had, the more you had to think about the elevator banks, because A, you didn't want to, if you were going all the way up to the 937th floor, you didn't want to be stopping at every floor. Then if you had express elevators, you'd have to organize them to how they go, where do you go, halfway up and then change and all that. I had a very fascinating BBC-type conversation with the guy. And it was, and the assumption there is that this is what's necessary to do to preserve the green space in our lands. That if you live in high-density population countries, like Belgium, for example, it makes sense to do that. Because otherwise, the city, as you say, the one- or two-story high city swallows everything up. And you say, you know, think about the enormous footprint of a one- or two-story high New York City. It doesn't actually, you don't actually have to imagine it, because if you take a plane at night over West Africa, and I always love this when twits like Hillary Clinton say, it takes a village to raise a child. No African actually wants to raise a child in an African village, never mind anybody else. They sold all the proverbs to Hillary Clinton and then skedaddled out of the village. So you've had enormous urbanization. And I mention West Africa just because I happened to do this flight. I don't know what it's like the rest of the continent. But so basically now, all down the west coast of Africa, you've had this tremendous flight in from the villages, and you have one great coastal megalopolis going on and on and on and on and on. Never ends. Cross national borders, never ends. Just shanties, just one giant shanty. And that's what New York City would look like once this idiot de Blasio has abolished the skyscraper. That's a very excellent point, Susan. Very well done. Toby Pilling writes, Extinction Rebellion got a pretty easy ride from the Metropolitan Police for blocking London's roads. Do you think that if Tommy Robinson had led a pro-Brexit protest involving similar civil disobedience, that the police would have been quite so hands-off? Well, these posers. Extinction Rebellion is this thing founded about a year ago by some academics in Britain. They're worried about, their model is Gandhi and Martin Luther King and the suffragettes, although unlike the suffragettes, they're not throwing themselves in front of the king's horse. We can but hope. They are doing it about climate change. Now, climate change isn't like votes for women. It isn't like civil rights in the United States. It isn't like home rule for India. It's just some elite little cause that you're never going to get. You're never going to be able to make yourself the suffragettes or Martin Luther King or Gandhi. It's not going to work out for you. But a couple of days ago, they actually basically shut down traffic in central London, at Waterloo Bridge, Parliament Square, Oxford Circus. And the police, the British police, are the most useless police in the world, unless you're Tommy Robinson. adopted, as Toby says, this hands-off approach to them. And of course, they wouldn't do that. Now, we've seen this. We've seen this same rotten bias from the British coppers, who, as my dear friend John O'Sullivan always says, are basically these days the paramilitary wing of the Guardian. So that they will protect, if there's a bunch of jihad boys marching through the streets, threatening to behead people, all the British coppers walk alongside, just in case anyone wants to get in the face of these would-be beheaders. So they let the beheading guys walk around saying, behead the enemies of Islam, behead those who defame the Prophet, behead this guy, behead that guy. But as you say, if Tommy Robinson were to... Well, Tommy Robinson doesn't even have to organise a protest. Tommy Robinson can be just sitting in a pub having a drink, and the Metropolitan Police will swoop down and arrest him for an unpaid parking ticket in 1987. That's just the peculiar priorities of the British police. Josh Passell writes, Passell, here's an actual question. What the hell is going on with Brexit? Could Nigel Farage be right that Leave and Remain will replace Tory and Labour as the political divide of Britain's future? I don't know about that. I don't know about that. Nobody else knows. It's not even like a Leave and Remain thing. Basically, what is happening is that the political class have actually consciously chosen to subvert Brexit. Now, because there's going to be elections for the European Parliament next month, May, and the United Kingdom should not actually be voting in those elections because they're supposed to have left the European Union by now. But instead, they've been given this sort of funny little extension by the Europeans because they can't decide on what terms they're going to leave. And as a result, they now have to participate in May's elections, electing members to a parliament they're supposedly going to be gone from in 3 or 4 months, whatever it is, which is completely pointless. Now, the way it works in the UK is that everything except a general election for Westminster is generally seen as a protest vote. So if you have by-elections or whatever, and historically, you know, some fringe candidate, doesn't matter whether it's a UKIP guy maybe or a Liberal Democrat or whoever it is, will do well, or a safe Tory seat will go Labour, because it's seen as a protest vote against whatever the national government is doing. Then when it comes to a Westminster, proper full Westminster general election, everyone votes sanely again, and either the Tories or Labour or whoever is returned to power. But this is actually, by definition, just a protest vote election, because you're electing people basically officially for a 3 or 4 month term of office in which they can't really, in a sense, they have no legitimacy to vote or participate in Parliament. They should just sit on their hands. Why they should be voting to influence the course of EU affairs when Britain is committed to leaving the EU? So this is a completely pointless exercise. And Nigel Farage formed a new party like 10 days ago or whatever it was, the Brexit Party. And what's interesting to me is that he, in some of these polls, he's tied with the Tories and Labour in the European elections at about, they're all sort of around, I think the poll I saw was about 22%. 22% Conservative, 22% Labour, 22% Brexit Party. Which means, I think, what's the interesting thing about that to me is that he's taking votes from both sides. It's not just a Tory split. There's some old Labour votes that actually want to leave the European Union. And this is what puts it in the sort of local nationalist globalist split that you also see in some of the Trump support. That there are people who are left-wing on economic terms. They believe in a big social welfare state. They don't want to disturb social benefits and so on, but they would just like to be in their own country. And I said this on Tucker, that I think this is actually where the space is. The old left-right divide essentially as an economic divide, is less relevant now than these sort of crude cultural instincts between people who want to live in something that's still recognizably the place they were born into, and people who just want to live in a sort of globalist mélange where everything's the same, and rather boring, in fact. And I think there's going to be a lot more of that in future. Certainly, it goes way beyond these stupid elections in May. But I think, in the end, my sense is this, that if Nigel and the Brexit guys were to really sweep those European elections, I think that would actually tell something. It would have consequences for the Tories, because it would basically say there is a huge bunch of your voters who are willing to punish you for what you did. And that in itself will, I think, make them anxious to put Brexit one way or another behind them. And the way to put Brexit one way or another behind them, I think, is no deal. And so I think a big victory for Nigel Farage would be good for no deal. Owen Morgan writes, now that the likes of Greta Thunberg, she's this Swedish schoolgirl who is the most brilliant person on the planet, because she cares about the planet, not like you old white dead people. So Greta Thunberg and Extinction Rebellion are the true exemplars of virtue in the West. Is there any case for not lowering the voting age to 16? Or even limiting it altogether to a clear-eyed idealistic bracket, say 14 to 22? Well, actually, I think given the subversion of the popular will that you see in something like Brexit, given the subversion of the 2016 election that you see in what they've done to Trump, I think that at this point, I think we might as well just say, oh, yeah, votes from six. You can vote from 6 to 14. 6-year-olds to 14-year-olds can vote. Couldn't be any worse, could it? That is a good point, Owen. George Pereira writes, the real unanswered question is why virtually everyone across the globe are such cowards. Do they not know we normal people see them for the worthless cowards that they are? Even as they pontificate to us on their moral superiority as our betters, we see them wearing no clothes. They must know that. And hate us even more. I don't think I want to go near that. If you see them wearing no, I don't. With some of the people you're referring to, I don't know whether I do want to see them wearing no clothes. Lawrence Brennan writes: we've seen the Democrats and assorted leftists and sympathisers control the dialogue for years, using mealy-mouthed euphemisms like religion of peace and undocumented workers, with Easter worshippers only the latest of this. What can we do, especially since so many non-Trump Republicans go along with this and the media are happy to echo it? Can social media alone reach the rest of us, especially with the Twitter and Facebook lords being gatekeepers now? No, social media is the enemy. It's made the internet a total bore. The control of the great thing about the Wild West internet of 10, 15 years ago was far more fun than the new social media internet, which means that if you've got control freak tendencies, like the Chinese Politburo do, like Angela Merkel does, like Theresa May does, you couldn't do anything about that 15 years ago. You couldn't control the internet. It was a big, messy, uncontrollable place. There were some left-wing sites, certainly. There used to be things, I don't even know where they're out there. Things like Talking Points Memo, which looked at, and the Daily Kos, and things that aren't sort of important. They were openly left-wing and messily left-wing and extremely left-wing. And you had lots of other voices too. Now you just have the thought control, ever more open thought control imposed by the. So you can invite three or four people to talk to the Chinese Politburo, to come and talk to Angela Merkel in the Chancellery's of Power in Germany, come and talk to Theresa May in Downing Street. Just have three or four people around the table. And you can and you can all get together and control the internet, and that's very bad. And on the language point, Lawrence, Yeah, I don't like it when conservatives accept the language. You notice I don't say, I'm specific about this. When I don't talk about gender, I talk about the sexes. That's what they are. They're two sexes. And you can have lots of variations. There are people who are, you know, historically not happy with the sex they were born as and want to live in some other way. And for the most part, good luck. I don't wish them ill. I think I mentioned this. Did I mention this once? We all dressed up, entered some talent competition. I dressed up as schoolgirls when I was, 17 or 18. We sang one of the then current pop hits. I was in a little tartan miniskirt and fishnet stockings, padded bra. Loved it. Loved it. I'd be quite happy to go around like that for the rest of my life. But does that mean we should assault biology and the reality of life and have things like birth certificate? Now talking about the sex you're, quote, assigned at birth, as if that moment when the doctor pulls the baby out and says, congratulations, it's a boy, congratulations, it's a girl, is just his assignment, his random assignment. When you use the word gender, as far too many so-called conservatives do, you're actually going along with that. Gender is something that applies to nouns in languages, and we should think very carefully about adopting leftist talk. They use phrases like Easter worshippers for a reason, because they don't want to say that Christians are under attack around the world, because they don't want Christians to start thinking of themselves as victims, and they don't want Christians to become a legitimate victim group. So Easter worshippers is a way of avoiding that. And, you know, when Al Gore used to talk about religion, he used to say, those of us in our faith tradition. Well, one sign that you have a faith tradition is that you don't use the words faith tradition. So when you surrender language, you're giving up key weapons in the battle. We've given up the weapons in the battle of ideas. So you're ensuring that you're waging the battle of ideas with an empty armory when you surrender language, because the left does this deliberately. Mark Shear writes, I think I'm paraphrasing your brilliance. When you stop defending the right to draw cartoons, it's a few short years before you are defending the right to have cathedrals and churches. You've been seeing this coming with stunning accuracy, whether in France or Sri Lanka. Well, you know, I don't think I've particularly seen it coming. I mentioned this when I spoke at the Danish Parliament, because people say, well, what does it matter? Denmark's just some little nothing country, you know, who cares what happens to it? Because the idea that and Americans, I think, because of history, understand this differently from the way a Pole would or a Belgian would. But in fact, the idea that you can survive as a sort of citadel of liberty, just surrounded by a wasteland of tyranny, is preposterous. Is because, as we already see, Hollywood makes films for the global market. They don't really care. You know, Americans might be gung-ho champions of liberty and small government, but Hollywood is making films for young men in huge multiplexes across China as much as anybody else. And they're not really interested in American ideas about liberty. So that all these little small places do matter. So if you say, oh, we'll surrender this place and we'll surrender that, we're not going to fight for some cartoons. I try not to get into disputes with members of the American right, because they can be a bit touchy. But when Rich Lowry was saying, well, we really don't want to be bothered defending statues, Civil War statues, Jefferson Davis, but if they come for statues of Lincoln and George Washington, obviously we'd feel differently about that. Well, no sooner than he said it than they started doing exactly that. You have to be able, the idea, again, it gets back, the thing we come back to every other week now. Every hill is the hill to die on, Because if you let yourself just be nibbled away at the edges all the time, tyranny always starts out on the fringes. I saw this in Canada because it happened to me. That these laws were set up, the anti-hate speech laws were set up basically to chastise so-called Nazis living in their parents' basement somewhere on the prairies. So the kind of people who attracted the attention of this law, nobody cared about because they were nobodies. They were people who would be running off photocopies of their manifestos. I think it was pre-photocopies, actually. I think there were carbon copies, a lot of them. And they'd be posting them in telephone booths. And so the anti-hate speech guys came after them. And nobody cared because they had no friends, these people. They were friendless neo-Nazis on the fringes of the map. And then suddenly it all started, because it emboldens people, they work their way in. And the people who've had these victories against the friendless neo-Nazis suddenly realize that nobody cares about principles like free speech. And so what happened then was that they came after me up north. And we pushed back. Ken White at McLean's and Julian Porter, our great, tremendous QC. And we pushed back. And that law wound up getting repealed. But it was like all these things. All tyranny always just starts off on the fringes of the map and then moves inward. So the best place to roll it back is at the fringes of the map, because if you won't defend cartoonists in Jutland, then the next thing you know is you have, like they have in France, a wave of church vandalism, and you have serious people talking about how, for example, with this fire at Notre Dame Cathedral, whether we really need to rebuild it the way it was, and that maybe that doesn't reflect the new French state, and perhaps we should put something that's more welcoming of, you know. And so suddenly it's not just the cartoon that's offensive, it's your church that's offensive. And that's why when tyranny starts at the fringe of the map and starts to work its way in, you should always push back against it when it's on the fringes of the map, because that's always the easiest way to do it. Here's a local question. Malcolm Whitners says, Mark, a provincial question. It's mud season up north in New Hampshire, a grim time of year. I don't know about that. I like the mud, actually. I used to have a very unruly driveway for mud season, because it took me years and years to figure out a way how to tame it. So it like had huge, thick ruts at this time of year, and used to throw up a lot of mud. And I used to love, I used to love basically the way I was just like a great, I'd get down to the road and I would just like be, the whole vehicle would be covered in mud. And I'd have the wipers going just to get a little hole in this little smear of liquid, so I could see through the mud or everything. But I used to, if there were ever going to be a New Hampshire superhero, he would be Mudman or Mud Creature. He would be like a version of the Incredible Hulk, but just emerging, dripping from mud on a Class 6 road somewhere in New Hampshire. So I like mud season. Anyway, Malcolm says, speaking of the Granite State, have you met any conservative men or women in your travels here who could take on Senator Shaheen and send her off into retirement? She's part of the DC cabal and an example of why we need term limits, although admittedly a nice person, just confused and in the liberal world. Well, she's a nice person. When you meet her, she's very pleasant. That's not to be disdained. But she has that combination, which I think the Democrats work well for, these Democrats, where you're pleasant but ruthless. And I would mark out Jean Shaheen as pleasant but ruthless. It gets back to what happened when the Conservatives lost in Canada. And what may well happen to the Australians, the Australian government in a couple of weeks, is that you can be in office, but unless you're moving the ball in your direction, when you're thrown out from office, it's as if you were never there. And Republican New Hampshire, for too many years, was content just to represent, just to occupy the offices of state, and not actually seriously advance conservative ideas. And that's true of Mr. Harper's party in Canada, and it's true too of poor old ScoMo and the gang, Scott Morrison and the gang in Australia. You can't just sit in the office. You've got to be actually advancing conservative ideas out in the wider world. Otherwise, you're just a guy with an R after his name trying to get elected in a state which has a D after its name. And that isn't going to work, not going to work for too much longer. Jill Felsan writes, "Hi, Mark, do you believe that Attorney General Barr will actually bring about a real reckoning with the evildoers who weaponized government agencies against the Trump campaign and then the Trump presidency? If yes, how far will it go?" I hope he does. Because I think this is outrageous what has happened. I think this was basically an organized coup against what initially the political opposition and then the duly elected government of the United States. So that has to be punished, Jill. And we're going to pursue that thought in an upcoming edition of the Mark Stein Show, which I hope you will want to watch. Thank you so much for all your questions. We always get more than we can deal with, and that's why we like to do a Mark's Mailbox and deal with a few of them that way too. So we'll pick up a few of those in a video edition of Mark's Mailbox. As I said, we're approaching the second birthday of the Mark Stein Club, and we hope you'll want to join us for a rollicking third year as we go gallivanting across the next 12 months, including our cruise from Vancouver to Alaska. As I said, if you're down in the hold with all the scurvy knaves, we've still got a couple of berths down there. It can get a bit rank on about the fifth day out, but it'll still be very pleasant. We do let you upstairs once in a while to come to all the great Mark Stein shows we'll be doing on the cruise. So we do hope to see you on the cruise. And we've got a bunch of other stuff planned for our third year too. We're alive and kicking. We're not kicking that much. We're not doing like Radio City Rockettes type of kicking because I've got one leg tied behind my back by tedious litigation from these Blaze TV losers. But we are sort of semi-kicking as well as a one-legged Rockette can. So we do hope you will join us again for the upcoming third year and for our Clubland Q&A. And that's all we have time for today, but we will see you next time.